are you?
A long time ago, in a university center not so far away, brave individuals came together to make a community-based radio station.
Now, 30 years later, CFRU 93.3 needs your support to continue playing the best of alternative music and independent artists.
The Raise Your Voice funding drive runs from October 23rd to the 31st and needs donations to widen its volunteer base as well as upgrade its website and equipment.
Celebrate the past year of radio with us. Look for events coming to a venue near you and come out, or simply make a donation by calling into the station between the 23rd and the 31st. Help us make your voices heard.
People of Earth, we realize that past relations between your world and ours have been strained on account of our repeated and failed attempts to enslave the human race. But we implore you to please heed our humble warnings against a more powerful force in our universe, the Central Services Radio Program, which airs on this radio station Monday mornings at 10 o'clock. Do not, we repeat, do not listen to Central Services. We have studied this broadcast. This is 1 hour of your life that you will never get back. The music is obnoxiously enjoyable, and you may be compelled to like it. A lot. This spells danger for the entire galaxy. Once again, do not listen to the Central Services radio program, Monday mornings at 10 on CFRU. That is all.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global, unembedded, independent, international investigative news hour, broadcasting every weekday here on CFRU at 11 a.m. If you support uncensored independent media, please consider donating some money during the annual Raise Your Voice funding drive happening this week at CFRU. Your contribution is integral to the station and its ability to provide programming like this to the Guelph community. Thank you so much for supporting Democracy Now! On CFRU 93.3 FM. Keep the phone calls coming in. You make it possible for CFRU to continue. I'm Amy Goodman.
To make a donation to CFRU right now, call 519-837-CFRU. That's 519-837-2378. Operators are standing by. Or use our PayPal setup at www.cfru.ca.
You are listening to These Things That People Make. Hello, my name is Sarah Mangle. I've been doing These Things That People Make for a year and a half, and very happy doing it. I'm reflecting on the time that I spent doing the show, and I'm playing snippets from different people I've interviewed over the last year and a half. And so I played an interview with Rebecca Singer describing the Knit Your Own Beard project, and then I played an interview with Alicia Lim about their 100 Butches project, and then I played an interview with Liam Michaud about the Prisoner Correspondence project. And I just want to let you know that if you want more information about the Prisoner Correspondence project, you can visit Prisoner Correspondence Project, all one word, .com. And last year I did a series of shows on zines about sickness, health, and medicalization. I want to play a few of those. I found that process really, really rewarding. And just kind of like more going in more depth and collecting a bunch of resources and having sort of ongoing conversations about how people navigate that system. And found it particularly helpful. So I want to play for you an excerpt that Claire Barrera, who wrote When Language Runs Dry, she edited it. She wrote in it. It's a collaborative zine project, and it's called When Language Runs Dry, A Zine for People with Chronic Pain and Their Allies. And it's edited by Claire Barrera and Meredith Butner. And so Claire is just going to read for us her piece in When Language Runs Dry, in the second edition, number 2.
So the name of the piece is Fake It Till You Make It. When I was 19, my therapist was a young German woman on her way to getting certified as a union analyst. Once a week, I went to her office in the West Village in hopes that she would help me out of my severe depression. It seems in hindsight like it was winter for the entire 9 months I lived in New York. All my memories are of gray concrete and icy wind, slushy subway steps, and sunset at 4 p.m. Everything I did during that time, I did on automatic, like a robot. If I hadn't had my nanny job to get me out of my studio apartment 5 days a week, I probably would never have gone outside. Whereas an accomplishment for me before the depression might include working in a collective or writing a short story, now it meant getting myself fed and dressed every day. And, of course, going to see my therapist, Frauke, every week. In one such session, with Frauke, the topic of my spirituality arose. I had been a very spiritual child, not religious, although I was raised Catholic and went to church most every Sunday for the first 15 years of my life. My spirituality was something I was born with and nurtured through my play, through dance, and through reading. I had my own beliefs and rituals that did not come from my family or community, but that I practiced on my own. The things I knew and felt changed as I grew, but were never absent from my heart, not until I hit that depression. Often when people try to distinguish between depression and other dark states of being, such as grief, they note that depression is not an excess of feeling, but a lack of it. It is the inability to connect with oneself and with the world. From my own experience of depression, I would agree, and I would say that when I was depressed, I also lost the ability to connect with the spirit world. I no longer had an innate sense of my spirituality. When I looked inside myself, my inner world had gone from 3 to 2 dimensions, a flat image with no horizons. If I tried to grasp a feeling or a belief, it turned to vapor and floated out of my reach. So one day I found myself telling Frauke about my total disconnection from my former spirituality. "I can't feel or believe in anything anymore," I said in our session. Frauke acknowledged the depth of this loss, and then she said to me, "You don't believe right now. I can hold this belief for you. I will believe for you until you can believe again." I found her response extremely comforting, and it has stayed with me ever since. I have often used this phrase in other ways with people I was supporting through a struggle, perhaps letting a friend who felt hopelessness know that I could feel that hope for them until they were able to feel it again themselves. What I learned from that part of my life was a sort of fake-it-till-you-make-it tactic for surviving an extremely dark time, the sort of time in which all the laws you have previously lived by do not apply anymore, and there is nothing to anchor you to the earth. I was going through the motions of a lot of things without really connecting to them. That meant brushing my teeth. It meant going out with someone to a museum. It meant reading a book. I believe that while I couldn't feel the benefit of those actions as I performed them, they contributed to my eventual resurfacing from the depression. My spiritual self, too, lay dormant. But I let Frauke hold it for me until I began to thaw. Then it was there for me stronger than before. Should I keep going or should I stop?
I want to hear more of it.
Okay. When I developed chronic back and pelvic pain, there were a lot of parallels to that earlier time of darkness. Mostly this is because I sank into a serious grief and depression as my condition worsened with no promise of an eventual recovery. The numbness, the inability to connect to everyday life, and the things that sustained me returned. Additionally, I was on a lot of pain meds that dulled my senses, and the pain caused me to check out of my body in order to endure it. My birthday, that first year I developed chronic pain, I just sat in my chair at my party in a haze of pain and narcotics. I watched the proceedings from a distance, unable to feel the sunshine, taste the food, or bond with friends. During this crisis time, at the onset of my illness, I felt even more estranged from myself than I had during my depression at age 19. Maybe because I had developed such a powerful toolkit during my previous hardship, I charged full force into the care of this new condition. In spite of how checked out I felt, I advocated strongly for my needs and sought out information and healing with drive. It was drive, but I was definitely on automatic. Some part of me believed that I needed to do these things to take care of myself, but I did not feel hope or passion about them. quite the opposite. With the help of a bureaucratic healthcare system that seemed to delight in throwing obstacles in my path, I mostly felt extreme hopelessness. I just felt like when I was 19, my sense of the sacred was painfully absent. This crucial aspect of my sense of wholeness and well-being had absconded once again. So I found myself a second time in the position of going through the motions. In some ways, it was easier because I had the success of that last time to remind me that it is possible to come out on the other side of seemingly endless crisis. I think that's part of what motivated my self-advocacy, which included a search for spiritual healing. The problem with a spirituality that has not been cultivated by the family or the community is that a practice is not passed on. I made my practice up as I went, but there was little concrete to hold on to when times got tough. I didn't know what resonated with me a lot of the time. Trying to find what felt right when I was depressed and checked out was even more difficult. I ended up testing a number of different methods of healing and spiritual practice and coming as close as I could to something that felt right. One of the first things I did was get energy work from, surprisingly, an MD who worked in the chronic pain clinic at my hospital. He was a nice old man who'd primarily worked with veterans and who did all the allopathic stuff but believed in energy and crystal healing as well. I also worked for a long time with a witch who helped me develop a strong visualization ritual. I saw a talk therapist and later a movement therapist as well. I studied curanderismo on my own. None of these things made my pain go away, and none of them were powerful enough that I felt a full revival of my connection to my spirituality. But I did them anyway. I ended up taking bits and pieces from each practice and making my own that primarily consisted of a series of rituals I performed in front of my altar nightly. I had actual physical exercises I did with my body from physical therapy and a series of visualizations as well as tasks like lighting the candles on my altar. I did them dutifully every night for months and months. Sometimes I found them soothing. Other times I found them hollow and could barely get myself to try. Sometimes my practice of these rituals was purely fueled by rage. But I did them, and I kept going to my many appointments with various healers as well. I kept getting out of bed and going to work and buying groceries and everything else that was daily life. You don't wake up one day and suddenly have it back. You're not suddenly past the crisis. You don't suddenly feel good and alive again. It happens very slowly, and it's not a straight line, but a series of ups and downs where the ups reach a little higher and the downs less low.
You are listening to These Things That People Make on CFRU 93.3 FM. And I just played for you Calabria, reading from When Language Runs Dry. And I encourage you to find that zine and read it. And if you need help finding it, send me an email, sarah.mangle@gmail.com. They're always looking for submissions. I bet they're working on a new issue. And do want to thank everybody who has donated to my show so far. We just got a phone call. It's so exciting. I need to thank Anna Leventhal, Craig Hunter, Martina, Jess Smith, Jennifer Kelly, my parents, Jane and David Mangle, and Emma Mossbrender for all donating to my show. It's so fantastic. Thanks so much, everybody. So that brings our total up to $6,343, which is great. And so I'm going to play for you another interview in the series of zines about medicalization, sickness, and health that I played over February and March of last year. And I'm going to play for you Dave Roche. He's reading from his zine about my disappearance. Dave Roche writes about his personal experience having Crohn's disease and does a great job of it. So I'm going to play for you an excerpt from him reading from the beginning of About My Disappearance, number 3. Once again, if you want to call in and make a donation, call 519-837-CFRU.
First issue of About My Disappearance. I titled it Self-Portrait at 30, which is a, I don't know, it's a really bad title. And not only that, but it's one I stole, too. It's about having Crohn's disease and what I went through. I shit myself 3 times over 4 days. Do you know what that does to your confidence, to your self-esteem? Diarrhea 5 times a day for over a month and a half. I had no appetite and couldn't eat more than a can of soup and half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich a day. I fear I lost almost a pound a day, dropping to 99 pounds after a little more than a month. I never had any energy, and I spent most of my day in bed. Between the fevers and having to run to the bathroom, I never got more than 3 hours sleep in a row. I always felt half asleep, if not half dead. Every trip to the bathroom and every meal, no matter how small, was followed by debilitating abdominal pains, forcing me to lie curled up in bed until it subsided into a manageable dull ache. My asshole was so tender from a month and a half of constant diarrhea that it hurt to cough. I developed a sore in my tongue, and my ass was out of hemorrhoids. I couldn't eat, sit, or even walk without some pain. I hated myself for falling apart like this. I'd lie awake at night, a little delirious and drenched in fever sweat, whispering the most vitriolic curses at my body. I started wishing I wouldn't wake up. One morning, I made the mistake of looking at myself naked in a mirror before I showered. My emaciated body looked like a morbid caricature of someone about to die, every rib visible, my stomach concave, a thin veneer of skin wrapped around a trembling skeleton. I wanted to cry. When you find your own body repulsive, you don't rebound so easy. This is why I didn't return any calls, why I canceled plans, why I disappeared. I was so ashamed of myself I couldn't face anybody. I didn't feel like a person anymore. I didn't even feel like a ghost. A ghost has some romance to it, a history. I had no history, just this interminable present. I just had sickness and shit and confusion, weakness and purposelessness. I didn't have a disease, I was a disease. How could I face you like that?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your love. When I was falling in the seizure of pain, oh, thank you.
mind was broken into a thousand pieces. But thank you for your love. Oh, thank you. Ooh. Oh, thank you. Ooh. Oh, thank you. Ooh. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So we're reaching close to the end of CFRU's These Things That People Make Funding Drive show. The funding drive is going to continue along until Halloween night. And I want to encourage you to consider donating or just call and say why you like CFRU. People are working really hard to fundraise this week, just like they work hard every week. Just so all of you know, all of us here who do shows are volunteering. And I put in a whole bunch of hours. Even though I work here at the station, I don't get paid for the hours that I put into my radio show. It's all love, and it's all love from everyone who do radio shows. And I do want to say, I was playing David Rosh's piece. I was like, wow, this is heavy, but also like so valuable. And I wanted to say that, like, I don't know, community radio is not always happy. My radio show is not always happy. It's not always easy to listen to. But that's kind of the point. This CBC public radio glosses over issues really easily. It's rare that you get someone speaking for themselves, especially for doing news pieces. Some famous people get to speak for themselves, but it's rare that people affected by issues who haven't reached a certain stature of stardom get to speak for themselves. And also, commercial radio is just offensive. So, I mean, public radio and commercial radio, in terms of like keeping it real or having any kind of real conversations, you gotta look hard. I mean, it exists, but it's hard to find. And community radio fills the space where people are having real conversations, and that's why I also love my show. I really appreciated having Dave Rosh write about his relationship to Crohn's disease, and I totally appreciate that he put out a zine and then was willing to actually also These Things That People Make. We hosted a backyard reading show with Jeff Miller of Ghost Pine and Dave Rosh. They came and read, and it was amazing. So I want to just the last thing I'm going to play. I interviewed a handful of people, Caleb Latroy, Liv Caro, Griffin Epstein, and my brother, Aaron Mangle, about house shows. And a house show, if you're not familiar with it, is a concert in a person's house, and they're awesome, and it's a lot of ways that touring musicians actually make money, believe it or not, is through the house show. And so I wanted to just close out today's show, These Things That People Make, talking about how to put on a house show. I do want to say that I have a lot of exciting radio shows coming up in the next little while. I made some lists the other day, and I'm really pumped about them. So thanks so much for listening. Check out my blog, These Things That People Make, blogspot.com, and stay tuned, and come in and make your own radio. You're invited, you. The person listening right now, you're invited to come make your own radio. Come see Brian here, the programming coordinator. Come hang out in our office and talk about your ideas. We would love to see you, and thanks for listening.
Final question is for somebody who's listening to this, who is like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to have my first house show. What's a recipe? What are the things that you would recommend that they make sure that they do?
Consider yourself as like a semi-professional. Like, it's not, the nice thing about it is it's not a professional deal, but you know, try to have a lineup and start on time. You know, do things that are considerate for the bands playing. Like, give them a time slot, roughly. Like, collect door money. You know, definitely the most important thing about any show is promotion. Like, above all, like, you've got to promote it or no one's coming. And I think with house shows, you can be real creative. Like, you can pass out flyers at work. You can, if you go to school, you can, like, advertise in your school, which is really easy. I think word of mouth is usually, like, really effective, but better if you have something to give them. So, like, you know, make a little flyer, talk to everyone you know. I've also had, I mean, Facebook is, like, really flooded with information these days. But if you make execute a good Facebook invite with, like, a nice picture on it, it will help. Because then people have a reference point, like, okay, it's at this address at this time. Here's, these friends of mine will be there, like, I'll go, okay. But other than that, it's, you know, it's like throwing a party. You just make sure people know about it, where it is, when it is, and have them show up. And beyond that, I think, like, try to be considerate of the bands and, you know, maybe make a meal together beforehand. That's always a nice thing.
Make sure you're comfortable with who's playing. I mean, that's the great thing about houses, is, like, you don't have to invite people into it who you're not comfortable with. I mean, sometimes you do by accident, but but that's generally, you know, few and far between. And especially if someone's performing in your house, like, it should be someone you're excited by. Because if you're, I don't know, I feel like if you're not, then you're going to get really stressed out. You're going to get stressed out anyway. I always do anyway. But if, even if someone who I really like, well, kind of especially if someone whose music I really love is playing in my house, like, I get stressed out because I want it to be really good. And it would be really unfortunate if you have to go through that stress for something that you're not that thrilled about. Because if everyone's just, like, on the same page of excitement and enthusiasm, then, like, mistakes are forgiven. But if you're not enthusiastic, then it's just like,
There are, like, lots of different kind of categories of preparedness that I would want them to think about, right? And the first is, like, geography. Like, are you in an accessible spot for folks? Are you near transit? Does it make sense to have the show at your house for folks getting there? Have you talked to your neighbors? You should talk to your neighbors. Have you thought about whether you're going to have it on a weeknight or a weekend, and will that make a difference for your neighbors? And then inside the house, like, are all of your housemates comfortable with it? What do your housemates need to feel comfortable or safe with it? Sometimes that's, yeah, I'm great having a house show, but let's not have anyone come upstairs to the bedroom, because I might need to check out and, like, go chill by myself in my space, and I don't want to feel like the whole house is turned into a party.
Yep.
And making those things really clear, both with the folks outside of your house but in your immediate area and the folks inside your house, like, to me, that's the first thing you really need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think about the physical requirements of your space, like, can you have amplification? Do you have to get stuff for amplification? Do you have room for folks to sit and stand if they want to?